Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Full Service Radio.
Hello everyone, this is Everyday Enviro on Full Service Radio, a show about the little things you can do to minimize your personal carbon footprint. My name is Danielle Vogel, founder of Glens Garden Market in DuPont Circle, and today I'm joined by author, blogger, publisher, food policy activist, and devout locavore, Renee Katakalos. Renee, welcome.
Thanks.
You've been involved in the local food movement for years, and you've examined it from all manner of perspectives. You even did a Barbara Kingsolver-esque experiment with your family to see if you could all be committed locavores for a month. And then you wrote a book about it called The Chesapeake Table. You were focusing on a 150-mile radius, which certainly means no lemons, bananas, or avocados. What else did you have trouble finding locally?
Yeah, those were some at the top of the things that we missed during that time. Things like coffee, tea, olive oil. We made some exceptions for those things, but my kids were real little at the time. So one of the big sacrifices for them, I think, was breakfast cereal. That was a big. We realized how much we had become dependent on things like that during that experiment. So much so that near the end of the month, my son and I actually did an experiment of making our own cereal, sort of like grape nuts. It took us like 2 days to make about two bowls worth of cereal. But I think it pointed out to him, who was an elementary school kid at the time, what it takes to make that kind of thing, how much processing actually can go into some of the foods that we were eating, and to understand how sometimes the simpler things that we can get easily are, just as good. Mm-hmm. And so that was a great part of the experiment, I think.
And I think in your book, you also mentioned you guys were missing things like salt and vinegar and grains. But in great news, we can get all of those things indigenously now.
That's right. I mean, we can get salt from West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
We can
get J.K. Dickinson.
Exactly. And more and more, we're seeing local grains, not just for personal consumption, like that we can buy at the farmer's market, but bakers being able to get grains in quantities they can bake with. I love the Selu bakery. Mm-hmm. And what they're doing with locally grown grains from Next Step Grains and some of the Pennsylvania mills.
So Next Step Produce is actually, they come to the DuPont Circle Farmer's Market every Sunday. So if you're looking out for them, you can source locally grown barley, oats, wheat, and rice, which are all things you had trouble getting when you were doing the experiment.
Exactly.
And then on the vinegar front, we've got two come to mind. One of them is Virginia Vinegar Works out of Charlottesville. And what they're doing that I think is particularly special is they're making a vinegar out of the Norton grape, which is a grape that's indigenous to Virginia. And then they're fermenting it right here. So that's a very local product.
Right.
And then, of course, Lindera Farms Vinegar, which I love deeply and dearly. This is a really innovative guy named Daniel Liberson, who is fermenting products that he's foraging off of his family's farm out in Virginia, and he's winning good food awards about it. So it's really, mm-hmm. really special stuff.
And Dragonfly Farms up in Mount Airy, Maryland, was doing grape and blackcurrant vinegars as well. I think they still are, but I haven't seen them at farmers markets lately. I'd have to look into where exactly they are.
Share that name again. I don't know that one.
Dragonfly Farms.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Look out for it. Where do you go to get it?
Well, I used to get it at farmers markets, but I think they changed their distribution model a little bit. So sometimes when you're working with the local companies, you'll find that they'll start out at farmers markets, mm-hmm. and then maybe they get to a point, of course, you know this, where they are, ready to distribute in other ways through stores or through partnerships, maybe with wineries or somewhere else where their product can be sold. And mm-hmm. then they aren't responsible for being at market so much. So
Yeah, we should do a whole show about that later on. Yeah. Actually, the voyage to distribution. It's right. A whole thing.
It is.
But anyway, back to your experiment for a second. Did you guys end up innovating substitutions for things that were hard to come by within a 150-mile radius?
I don't think so. I think we really were surprised to find how much was available within a 150-mile radius. I think that was the key. And I will say, you know, we did this experiment in like 2006, mm-hmm. so it was definitely harder then. And we actually spent about 3 or 4 months kind of researching before we actually did the experiment so that we would have an idea where we could get things. So we found, you know, plenty of meat, seafood we found, although I will say that even today, that one still is a little bit harder in terms of sourcing.
Unless you want to do like catfish and blue crab all day.
That's right. That's right. So surprisingly, we probably didn't eat as much seafood as you might think. But we found all manner of produce. We did the experiment in August. We tried to give ourselves as much of a good chance at not veering off our path as we could. And of course, there's tons of anything you could be interested in the area at that time. So I don't, you know, we really didn't miss a whole lot of things. We could get dairy, you know, maybe we weren't using Parmesan cheese. We did more things with local goat cheese, maybe feta type cheeses. There's a lot of cheddar. We definitely didn't eat as much bread. Because of the grain sourcing issue, and that if we were going to have it, we basically had to cook it ourselves then. And even doing like cornbread, you know, driving through the cornfields of Maryland, eventually realize that corn's not meant for us.
That is feedstock, my friends.
That is feedstock. And so even sourcing like local cornmeal that we could do cornbread with, we kind of had to go to some of those sort of historical reenactment mills around at the time that would, you know, one Saturday a month, there'd be volunteers there like running the stone mills and you could get some grain. And even then you had to be sure to ask them, did it actually come from the area? So
I'm envisioning like a Williamsburg kind of historical butter churn. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah. Like out at Y Mills on, you know, Maryland's Eastern Shore. Sometimes they dress up old timey. They don't always, but, but they definitely, it's the old timey mill with the stone things, you know, churning. And if you want to try it actually at Y Mills, my kids, you know, of course they like I said, they were small. They had like hand, cranked mills that you could use too. You could put a couple handfuls of corn in there and then you'd crank it for like, you know, 5 or 6 minutes and you end up with like, you know, a quarter cup of meal. But those kinds of things. Although there was also a place in Virginia, Wade's Mill, that was grinding local corn. They were doing some local wheat. It was a little bit early for like buckwheat at the time. Mm-hmm. I believe they've changed hands since that time, but I think that the new owners have been, you know, kind of reinvigorating those kinds of efforts as well. So I used to be able to order by mail order from them. So that kind of helped us through that month. Yeah.
To your point earlier, they are working with some distributors and they're in a couple of retailers. They've got a really pretty packaged product.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a great product when we were getting it too. I really appreciated it. Yeah.
Yeah. They've got some great stuff. Their cornmeal is delicious. Their pancake mix is excellent. I'm a big fan of the Wade's Mill products. So other than that one in particular, did you discover any other local producers of items that you didn't expect to find around here?
You know, I don't know. I'm not sure if we found anything really unexpected, but I think we did find more vegetables than we thought. We found honey. Honey was a big one that we hadn't really, you know, thought about. That became kind of like our go-to sweetener for things. Maple syrup out of Western Maryland and Pennsylvania. We were glad to be able to find that so that then, you know, as you said, we could still do pancakes or things like that. The wide variety of meats, I think, again, we weren't really thinking about it, but beef, lamb, pork, chicken from small, you know, pastured producers, all of those things, eggs were pretty readily available. And I think at that time it was a little bit early on the beverage side, kind of beers and wines. The selection was more limited than it is now. But, you know, apple cider, milk, all of those kinds of things. You know, I would not say that we had a hard time eating that during that month. What I will say, though, is it was more or less my full-time job to, like, source food and cook it. Yeah.
It's hard to remember a DMV sort of before the craft beer revolution that Port City started.
Yeah, yeah. But,
so to that point, I guess I've got to ask you, you conducted this experiment in 2006. Do you think it would be easier to source your food entirely locally now?
I do, definitely. And in fact, when I wrote the Chesapeake Table, originally I had thought, well, you know, I do start the book with a reprint of an article we wrote about that experiment. And I thought, well, maybe as the coda to the book, I'll like recreate the experiment and compare it. But when I got into it, I realized actually, I mean, it didn't even make sense because there are so many more outlets to get the food now. And after having written about all of those things through the book, it occurred to me that really everyone's experience to do that is going to be a little bit different. And that's kind of what the point of this book was now, even to say that wherever you're coming from, you can figure out how to do this now, and it's going to be a lot easier than it was then. I think that was the contrast comes through. It doesn't require that much research anymore to figure it out, and it doesn't require spending all of the hours and miles I did, like driving around to get the food and all. There are so many other distribution models. There's retailers like, of course, Glenn's Garden Market, and you, delivery is available for a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Farmers markets carry a much wider array of products, and there are many more of them. And even just your normal kind of day-to-day grocery stores are starting to trickle a few other things in. And I think other kind of surprising distribution points sometimes you might find, too, at a, say, a farm stand. You might find that they also have products from somewhere else, or they may be combining their sourcing with other farms, or you might be at a brewery and find that they have something from some other local maker, some jams or something like that. So it's actually kind of all around us if you just kind of open your eyes and are on the lookout for it.
So I think I'm hearing you say it's super easy to eat all local these days.
Okay, no.
Excuses are gone. moving on.
No, I'm not saying it's super easy. I'm saying it's easier than it was. It's
considerably easier.
Yes, yes.
Glenn's Garden Market makes it as easy as humanly possible.
Yes.
So you made an observation in your book that I really loved. You wrote, early on, we learned not to get frustrated, but let available foods lead the way.
Right.
And I call that the shop like a chef mentality. It's the idea that we should cook with what looks best and freshest, not what's on a list from a book or a magazine that may have been written months or years prior in a land far, far away. It doesn't require culinary training, just a bit of mindfulness and curiosity when you're shopping and cooking. Renee, what did you learn from your locavore experiment?
Yeah, I learned a couple of things. One, like I said, to be patient with it, to be open and creative. And I learned to listen to the people who are bringing food to us as well. I learned that farmers know a lot about the food they produce, and that asking about it, you can, find a lot of, discover new ways to use like old things, so to speak. And anyway, I'm an experimenter that way. I enjoy cooking. I enjoy trying new things. Even to the point where, working with going to farms to buy meat. I'm an omnivore. I'm eating all of it. I'm not a big eater of offal, as in internal organs and all.
Yeah, it's awful.
But some people really love it. And I mean, it's certainly a key part of, reducing food waste and being mindful about using, the entire animal that has been sacrificed for those meals. But, I have learned to broaden a little bit. So actually, you asked me earlier, what was something we maybe discovered that we didn't know was there, or maybe we didn't know we liked. And so one thing comes to mind, it's scrapple.
This is like sausage meatloaf for those unfamiliar.
Yeah. And I think that actually one of the first I think I once had at a tasting event a version of Scrapple, actually, that Spike Jurdy, who has his restaurant here in the line, had done, which, so of course, that was going to be very elevated and it was going to be super delicious. But even going around and like when buying meat in bulk from, I was in West Virginia and at a farm, a family farm, and I was buying some grass-fed beef, and then they had in the freezers some pork products too, and they had Scrapple, which by this time I have already come to kind of like. And I started to talk to the guy who's one of the cousins of this, you know, farm. I mean, it's not a fancy place or anything like that, mm-hmm. about the Scrapple. And then there were some other products in the freezer. There was something called pudding and something called Ponhaus, P-O-N-H-A-U-S. And these are all kind of like, it's sort of like, you know, extra virgin olive oil and then virgin olive oil and then, you know, the blended one or something. It's like these are various stages of like Scrapple and then what you do with like the liquid off of the meat that was cooked for Scrapple and then what you do with some other part of it. There's like three stages of this kind of, I mean, in its most basic form, sort of a processed, you know, product meat. Of the pieces that are left over.
But this is sort of a no waste cascade.
This is exactly, that is exactly what it is. And so I bought all three of them so we could take them home and compare them. You know, they have different mixtures of meat and grain and you know, kind of the broth, and they have different consistencies and all. So it was just, that was fascinating to me. I had never heard of those things, but I found them delicious.
So, and your kids did too?
Well, one of my kids. My son Lewis likes to experiment with those things with me. My daughter, Charlie, and my husband are not so much into it. But yeah. But that was from talking to the farmer and having them explain to me what that was and me understanding, you know, the differences and wanting to try that. So I think that's been one of the great things that comes from eating local.
So what about the aspiring locavore? Any tips for somebody that's looking to explore eating more locally grown food for the first time? Give us a roadmap for the rookie locavore.
Yeah. You know, for most people, the entry point is a farmer's market, you know, and we're starting to come back into the season when the seasonal markets open again. You know, if you're a hardcore locavore, you probably know where the year-round markets have been. There are definitely farmers markets that are still open during the winter.
DuPont,
Tacoma Park, Arlington, and, you know, a handful of others. But if you're aspiring, you know, April, start looking around. The seasonal markets will be opening. And, you know, just go with $10 and say, I'm going to see what looks good and what I'd like to try, and I'm going to spend $10. It might be a couple baskets of strawberries. It might be some salad mix. I think it's also important for people to really understand when you start to try to eat local, seasonality. So to figure out, and you know, you can find these things online from the departments of agriculture in the region or whatever, and it's in the book, you know, just find a seasonality chart so that you know what's going to be in season. Don't go to the farmer's market in April or May looking for corn on the cob or looking for peaches or looking for watermelons. You have to know when these things come into season in our area. So, and then it's also important to understand that more things will come in as the season goes on. So if you go and it looks a little bit sparse in the beginning of the spring, don't despair. Just stick with it.
So more on that, actually. So it's March right now. We're barreling toward the vernal equinox. What's going on at our local farmers markets this weekend? What should we seek out if we're looking to displace some of the more distantly sourced items in our shopping baskets?
You're probably still seeing, winter items right now. Sweet potatoes, things that, you know, winter vegetables and fruits like store through the winter. That's what people used to do with their root cellars.
They're in fact put called them in storage there. Crops.
Storage crops, exactly. So you will probably still see apples that have come out of cold storage. Like I said, sweet potatoes, some other root vegetables will be around. Mushrooms are a pretty year-round staple in a lot of farmers markets. And sometimes you see more of them in the winter because there's room in those markets for vendors with mushrooms to come out because there aren't vendors with the, you know, more well-known and showy summer crops. You may still see cider from some of the fruit vendors as well. Traditional farmers have been using season extension methods like hoop houses. so that you will still see salad greens. You might see some hydroponic cucumbers or tomatoes or something like that. So there's something all year round. Certainly meats are available all year round. So the farmers who sell those types of things will bring them frozen, or sometimes, you know, fresh, depending on what their schedules are, to the market year round.
And what about in the months ahead? What produce is going to be coming off of our local fields that's particularly excellent and worth seeking out?
Strawberries, definitely.
Heard, and asparagus.
Exactly. That's like the, you know, the dynamic duo of spring, you know, strawberries and asparagus. And they really are so much more amazing when they are picked ripe and here locally. And the thing about strawberries especially, too, is that the varieties that local farmers grow tend to be different from the one that you will get in a clamshell in the grocery store, which you can get all year round. And certainly they can grow them all year round in California. But that doesn't mean that we really should eat them all year round here. You know?
Yeah, I mean, the ones that are grown locally or the heirloom varietals are not engineered to bop off across the country in the back of an 18-wheeler.
That's right. And they're not engineered to be picked and, you know, unripe. With enough time, mm-hmm. unripe, to ripen during that period of time getting to the market. They're picked, you know, within the week that you have bought them. And when you get them home, you need to, like, eat them.
For
because
sure.
They are also not engineered to last forever. So you pick them, you got to eat them. You start doing the strawberry shortcakes. You start doing strawberries and cream, strawberries on your granola, you know.
And then
jam, definitely. It's great. Our local fruits are, you know, spectacular when they're in season.
Agreed completely. So I know that you're also a fan of community-supported agriculture programs. So those are otherwise known as CSAs.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us what those are and how they work?
Yeah. So a CSA, community-supported agriculture, is a... I think of it as basically like crowdfunding a farm in a mm-hmm. way. So that it's those of us who want to eat that farm's produce, pay the farmer up front, like during this time of the year, so that the farmer can buy their seeds and hire their staff to get their fields ready and do all the stuff they need to do up front before they have a crop to sell. So it keeps them afloat during that time and also lets them know they have a guaranteed outlet for what they're going to grow. And then when the crops start coming into season, everyone who has paid that share up front gets a box or a bag or a portion of vegetables each week from that farm over the course of their season, which could range anywhere from like 16 to, you know, 24, 26 weeks.
Are there any particularly great produce or meat CSAs in the DC area that you would recommend?
There are tons of great ones. I hate to make, you know, specific recommendations, but I will say one that I've long loved and have been an on and off member of over the years is the Claggett Farm CSA,
mm-hmm.
Which the farm is actually in Upper Marlboro, Maryland. It's a project of the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, actually. They do deliver to DuPont Circle, but most people pick up their shares on the farm. And it is, you know, Doing a CSA where you go to the farm to pick up your share just deepens that connection that you have to that farm and to understanding how they do things. That's one of the real benefits of eating locally, is the ability to really verify and understand and know how your food was grown, not just who grew it, but how it was grown. And you don't get that unless you actually get onto the farm. So even if you can't get out there for every pickup, getting out to a farm once or twice a season just clarifies things. It codifies like why you're doing that. And then the other thing I like about picking up my share at that particular CSA, and there are many others that operate this way too, is that it's not pre-boxed. The produce is out. They kind of give you a menu of like how much of each thing or combination of things you can get that week. So you still have that experience of kind of shopping. Yeah, yeah. Which some people miss from having a CSA, or some people feel like, oh, I didn't get any choice in this. This thing just showed up, which, you know, honestly is not a bad thing either. But that's kind of what I like about Claggett Farm. But there are so many great CSA farms out there that just find one that fits where you need to get it picked up, what sizes you can get, you know, what fits your budget. Any one of them will be a great start.
And in terms of meat TSAs, I think you were a member of the Cabin Creek Heritage Farm.
I am. Yeah. In fact, I just got, they just started doing some home delivery. And as I have been to that farm several times and have been traveling a lot. So I decided to opt for the home delivery this season. I just got my bag this weekend, and it's great. And that's kind of a relatively new development in CSAs over the past maybe 5 or 6 years. Especially because meat farms can freeze their products, it makes a lot of sense. And you can choose different sizes, number of pounds you want to get each month, or combinations of different meats, you know, depending on the farm. And it's a great way, especially if you have a little bit of freezer space, to just be sure you always have something on hand. So there's not like that excuse, I don't have anything to cook for tonight, so I'll just go to the grocery store and buy, you know, whatever, the chicken that you know is not the chicken you actually really want to eat. So I like just having, you know, there's some heritage bacon in the freezer all the time, and you know, I can always pull out a roast or pull out some ground beef. And you know, you still may supplement from the market or different things like that in between. But
so I think I know what to get you for Christmas now. It's the all offal package from the
I tell you what, I would make a real effort to try it.
You're a good sport. Say, Renee, is there anywhere we could go on the internet if we wanted to get more tips from you about incorporating local produce into our meal planning at home?
Well, you could look at my website, which is reneeeatslocal.com. And knowing that you might look at my website will encourage me to put more tips up.
But and more blog posts.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I do have links to various things there. And you can also follow me on Facebook at Renee Eats Local as well. So
do you have an Instagram feed?
No,
dot.
I do not yet.
So more we'll say, to come.
There you go.
We are talking with Renee Katakalos about eating locally in the DMV. And when we get back, we'll dive into economic sustainability and diversity and inclusion in the local food movement. Back in a sec. Welcome back to Everyday Enviro on Full Service Radio. I'm Danielle Vogel, founder of Glen's Garden Market, and I'm talking with author and local food enthusiast and activist, Renee Katakalos. Screwed that one up, Renee.
No, that was fine.
Sorry, Renee. Yeah, Katakalos. Yeah, I got that right.
That's
okay.
Good.
Renee, I own a local grocery store that I founded to make climate change progress. I'm a fourth generation grocer on a mission, and our story is pretty interesting. But without fail, every time I tell it publicly, I get the inevitable question, but what about the food deserts? Is eating locally something that's only accessible to the wealthy?
No, it is not only accessible to the wealthy. There are a number of different ways that people on limited budgets, on food assistance budgets, in food deserts can access local food. And in fact, accessing local food is one of the strategies that a lot of food access organizations are using to bring better food to food deserts. Locally sourced food can get to those food deserts more easily and directly. But one of the challenges is, as we kind of alluded to a little bit earlier, distribution. Mm-hmm. A lot of times can be a challenge. Glen's Garden Market is a great example of a grocer that is focused on this type of food, but it is a step that can be taken when people already have access to like do grocery shopping. And in a lot of the places that are, you know, underserved food areas, people don't even have a basic grocery store. So you can't really start kind of in the middle of that progression. And people have to look at just having a baseline of food available. But I think there's a lot of really encouraging work going on around urban agriculture, where people are growing food right in those neighborhoods. So they have a stake in how it's being grown. They understand that they have their own hands in the dirt and have that power over what they are going to grow and what they're going to eat. And they're also in the process, like cleaning up neighborhoods and being able to use unused property to generate, you know, food for the community. I think what's been really important to the success of some of those programs recently is that they really have to be community driven. There were attempts, you know, in the last decade or, you know, further back in the food movement to kind of come in and say, you know, okay, we think you need a farmer's market here, or we think that this should, well, the we was always the problem.
Right.
It's like, who is that we?
It was a superimposed conclusion.
Yeah, exactly. And the we has to be the people who are going to use those services, and they have to be empowered and supported in creating those food solutions in their neighborhoods.
So what are the best access points to locally sourced food around here for folks who may have restricted means?
Farmers markets, I mean, almost the majority of them these days are able to accept WIC checks or EBT cards to use their, you know, benefits, otherwise called food stamps. And a number of those markets also have programs where they can add additional value. If you are using $10 worth of WIC checks, you can get $10 extra in, they might be called double bucks or market bucks or something like that.
So this
that
is
you
like
can
the,
use.
The matching dollars program.
Matching dollars programs,
farm.
Yeah, right. And so something I think people don't always realize is that those matching dollar programs are funded sometimes by some government inputs, but they can also be funded by consumers. So, for instance, with the matching bucks at Fresh Farm Markets, people can donate to that program. And that's one way that that's an everyday kind of a step that those who have the means to shop at wherever they want to can support having other people shop that same way. You know, so if you're really saying you're concerned about people not having access to that food, there's a real easy way to help them have access to that food.
Make it accessible.
Yeah, yeah.
So what are the most significant systemic barriers to the proliferation of locally sourced food in our food system? That little one. I'll leave
okay,
that
that's
for
a
you.
Small question. Well, distribution is definitely one in terms of you know, where you're going to sell that food to people. So you know, like we said, if there's a lack of grocery stores, if there is a lack of community spaces where people can gather to buy food. And just funding for supporting local farmers markets. You know, you can do a farmers market that makes food affordable to people on a low income buyers. But you have to consider that the farmer on the other side of that transaction also
needs
to make some money.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're not like rolling in dough, a lot of them either. And there's also an issue with bringing farmers who look like the community into those communities too, whether that's through urban farming or through working with farmers of color who are in rural areas who can bring food in and connect with those markets. A lot of that kind of work is being done in Baltimore, but there's still costs involved with all of those things. So the lack of access to finances for those things is a big systemic barrier.
And I know you've done a lot of research into DC area farmers markets, particularly in disadvantaged communities, as we've been discussing. You've reached some conclusions about why some have succeeded and others have failed. Can you tell us a bit about what you've discovered?
Yeah, I think a lot of it goes back to whose idea it is. And I have, I've been really fortunate in the last couple of years to work with a group called the Chesapeake Food Shed Network, that's working throughout the Chesapeake Bay Food Shed to, have nonprofits and governmental entities and foundations and funders kind of collaborate about more systemic solutions to the systemic problems. And one of the big initiatives is around community ownership, empowerment, and prosperity. And I've been able to hear from people working in a lot of these organizations on the ground that are addressing the community ownership issue. It's like if the project hasn't come from the community and isn't owned by the community and benefiting the community, then the chances of it being successful are much lower. You know.
Naturally.
Yeah.
So what other tips can you share with us about eating well as we work to source our food locally?
You know, I think, and I think you include this in your tagline for this show in some way, but it has to do with just thinking, you know, just thinking about the choices that you are making. And in the book, The Chesapeake Table, and the very last chapter is actually called First Steps, where I try to break down for people the obstacles that they think they may have to starting on this journey of eating locally or supporting sustainable agriculture. And I feel like if you can take one step, like go to that farmer's market and spend $10, or seek out a if you're going to go to a brewery, find one that's using some local grains in the beers they're doing, or that has some seasonal varieties that have some local fruits. Or just take a field trip out to a farm once in the season and go see what's happening on it. I think if you can take an initial step and think about what that shows you, and then the next time you are buying some food, think about, how does this stack up to what I just got from the farmer's market? Or what does this label tell me about where this came from? Or is this actually in season? and if it's not, then why is it here and where did it come from? Then I think you continue to think about those things, and it becomes a slippery slope in a good direction, as mm-hmm. far as I'm concerned, that you know, continue to find other ways to incorporate it into your life. I just caution people from letting that become like paralytic. You know, I don't want to suggest that you need to analyze every single little, you know, decision you make. And if, you know, you eat out somewhere and you don't know that's a bad thing. People should not beat themselves up over not doing everything, mm-hmm. but at the same time, I think we should all do something.
That could not have been said more beautifully.
Yeah.
Progress one bite at a time.
Right.
So are there any other things you do other than eating locally and being mindful about sourcing that that help reduce your personal carbon footprint?
You know, thinking about our food makes us think about, say, how our food is packaged. You know, buying produce loose versus buying it wrapped in cellophane,
wrapped in plastic.
You know, we try to avoid using the plastic bags to put our food in it. You know, certainly the whole issue with straws. Mm-hmm. My husband has for years been, just like haranguing wait staff in restaurants about our needless consumption of single use plastic. So, but those little things make a difference. Little, you know, individual people continuing to make comments about that and to push about it results in things like DC banning plastic straws. Mm-hmm. So I think that all those little steps make a huge, huge difference.
Everyday enviro, as it were.
That's right. That's right.
Thank you so much for being here today, Renee. This has been super interesting and informative. Guys, go buy Renee's book right away. It's called The Chesapeake Table.
Sorry. Let me just interrupt.
Yes, please.
If I'm not mistaken, I think you can get that book at Glenn's Garden.
Oh, yes,
Market.
You can. We do sell it at Glenn's. You can also find it at Politics and Prose, or you could buy it on Amazon if you must.
If you must.
And thank you for listening to Everyday Enviro on Full Service Radio. If you have an idea for a show or a guest, or you have a question about how you can reduce your personal carbon footprint, hit me up by email. I'm at glensmarket@gmail.com. And in any event, I'll catch you again next week on Everyday Enviro, when we'll be talking with Kaya Chatterjee, author of the book, The Zero Footprint Baby. Talk then. Bye, friends.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.